I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Anyone who has visited Chicago's Loop has probably seen the famous Picasso sculpture in Daley Plaza. But when it was unveiled on August 15, 1967, it was compared to everything from a dodo bird to a giant cheese slicer. Kim Babon has been studying this and other controversies surrounding public art, and we'll talk about them today on Smart City. Also with us is Faye Nelson, who is leading the development of Detroit's riverfront. She is president and CEO of the Detroit Riverfront Conservancy. We'll talk about public art and public riverfronts as urban amenities today on Smart City. But first, the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Kim Babon has spent 9 years researching the public art debates, trying to determine why some pieces hit a nerve when others don't. She's a doctoral candidate in the University of Chicago's Sociology Department. Kim, tell me how you developed an interest in public art.
Well, I lived in Boston for many, many years, and I moved to Chicago to go to graduate school. And one of the first things I did was to explore my new city, and I was just astounded and really floored at the number and quality of the public artworks that were here in the downtown area. And I thought, not to put my former home of Boston down, but that Chicago really came out on top with these amazing public works. And it sort of intrigued me to wonder, what is the difference? How come Boston and Chicago are so different in the way in which they use the arts and the amount of art that actually shows up and appears in each city? And that sort of started my 12-year-long quest into understanding public art.
And why are Boston and Chicago so different when it comes to public art?
Well, it's not necessarily an easy question to answer at first. There are a lot of things that are very different about the two cities. One, I would argue, is that Boston has a very historical identity, very Paul Revere, and you sort of think of every step you take in Boston is a historical step, and the Freedom Trail reminds you of that, literally. And I think it makes it, in some sense, that's Boston's identity. It'd be very hard and very difficult to compromise that with lots of very cutting edge, very modern types of public art. Other factors are obviously city governments and what they prioritize. Here in Chicago, you had Mayor Daley, with a very amazing, sort of very ahead of his time, a vision of what Chicago could be. Chicago has that identity of being very cutting edge. It has the first skyscraper, amazing architecture. And Mayor Daley was actually very, he had a lot of foresight in sort of looking and seeing how he could enhance the city center. And one way to do that was to collect and amass one of the most amazing collections of public artwork, I think, in almost any city.
Let's back up a minute. And let me ask you, how do you define public art?
That's a really excellent question. I actually don't like to use the term public art. I prefer the term urban art because there is actually a difference. Public art, if you want to be technical about it, actually uses public funds, often from national or local sources, taxpayer money. And much of the art we actually see in urban locations and outdoor environments is privately funded or is a combination of public and private funding, mostly private funding. So public art is often a term that's used to just differentiate it from art that's found inside museums. But I prefer to use the term urban art.
You mentioned Mayor Richard J. Daley, the current mayor's father, who began the public art program in Chicago. And I've been reading a history of his administration, of his life, actually. And in it, it talks about the controversy around the Picasso, the great Picasso, that is now so much a part of the Chicago landscape on Daley Plaza. And it was extraordinarily controversial when it was unveiled. And the mayor himself did not like it particularly, but he stood behind it. And he had the courage to unveil it and to say, it stays here. And a lot of people actually wanted to move it. It reminds me of the many controversies surrounding urban art and public art, and you have documented many of those controversies. You've explored those controversies. What's behind those controversies? Why are they so vehement in terms of the public argument surrounding them?
The Chicago Picasso, as it's often called, is really interesting. And I do think there are actually a number of explanations that you need to look at in order to understand why art creates, in some cases, such intense reactions. I would actually argue artists are a little more upset when art doesn't create much of a reaction. But when they do, if you think about, I think there are many factors involved. One is how visible a sculpture is, literally. I mean, if you can't really see a sculpture, no one's really going to get too angry about it. Perhaps more importantly is where a sculpture is located. You think about the Chicago Picasso, it was at the very, very center of the city, the symbolic heart of the city. And many reactions at the time, they thought it was an Afghan dog, that it was a woman dog hybrid, that Picasso was pulling the wool over the city's eyes. And first of all, it's gargantuan. So it would be a huge multi-story joke on the city. And that's how many people interpreted it at the time. And it's not just a joke off in some far off corner. It's a joke in the literal center of the city. So people, I would say, want to defend where they live. They want to have art that is of good quality. Of course, that's what good quality is often what gets argued about. But what they see as good quality, and that in part that would be a positive reflection of them as a people, a positive representation of themselves, especially in a symbolic center of a city. So those kinds of art placed in those kinds of locations is very likely to be defended very strongly. They're very strong emotions about how we see ourselves as a city, how we see ourselves as a people, how we want to be represented to other people who come to our symbolic center. So I would say that's a very important aspect of why individuals get pretty angry over certain pieces of artwork.
Would you judge the Picasso sculpture as a good piece of art?
Oh, I don't know if I'm in that business. I'm just a sociologist, not an art historian. I would say, I've actually visited that sculpture many numbers of times, and I would say it is quite successful. And the reason for that is that it engages people. In some sense, when you can't ignore a piece of art, people are forced to look at it and confront it. Now, for some, that gets people angry. They don't want to necessarily be confronted with types and styles of art that they don't necessarily condone. But I think it's good in the sense that it gets people engaged in looking at the art. Kids slide down the base. It's very interactive. It doesn't have do not touch on it. That's one of the worst things I think that can happen with public art is just all, view from a distance, don't engage it. And I've seen this actually take place in other cities, in art, in parks, where you're literally there are signs, do not touch it, do not get close to it. And I don't think that that's really a positive positive way of having art act in our urban environment. I think getting people involved and interested in taking pictures and thinking about art and what it is, I think it actually engages individuals in that way. Aesthetically, is it my favorite piece of art in the world? Probably not. But it certainly is interesting to look at, and it interacts with its environment very well. It has an excellent scale for the space. It doesn't get lost. In some sense, it doesn't take over either. So I would say it's a successful piece of art.
Doesn't it serve as an example of art that at first is very controversial and there's a lot of pushback from the public, but then over time, again, it becomes this beloved part of the landscape. No one can imagine the Loop in Chicago now without its Picasso. So how do you create an understanding, or do you, by the public, that perhaps art takes time? Perhaps it takes time to learn to understand it, to live with it, then to love it.
This that argument that you're just suggesting about time is one that the art community actually often raises during these controversies. They use their knowledge as experts of the arts to sort of suggest, well, you all may not like it right now, but if we listened to general the public taste and popular taste, we wouldn't have the Eiffel Tower. Impressionism would not really be, would not really exist. So there is something to be said for artists bringing out that argument, and it is brought out, but it's very hard for people to see beyond the here and now. As far as understanding how art becomes beloved or embraced over time is actually a project I'm hoping to work on in the future. I don't really have a good answer for that right now, quite honestly. If you think about not all sculptures become beloved. For example, the Richard Serra's Twain in St. Louis in the Gateway Mall. I interviewed a large number of individuals there, and it was hated when it was first placed. People thought it was a construction wall. They didn't think it was art. They thought it was dangerous. It was these rusting steel panels. There was a park there that people actually liked before that was taken away for the sculpture to be placed there. And today, when 20 years later, actually closer to 24 years later when you talk to individuals, they still think it's a construction wall. They still hate it, even though, like our Chicago Picasso, it is a tourist destination. It is a world-renowned artist. He doesn't have that many sculptures in urban spaces throughout the U.S., so it is a tourist draw. It is part of their cultural capital of St. Louis, yet we don't have what we see here in Chicago, sort of an embracing. And I still think that's a mystery, kind of a puzzle I still want to solve.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Kim Babon, a PhD candidate in sociology at the University of Chicago. You mentioned Richard Serra. His tilted arc in New York was actually removed from a plaza there. What happens when public art or urban art simply misses the mark?
There are a lot of positions there that you sort of suggesting. I mean, this is a personal opinion that art can be challenging, and in some sense, maybe should be. Now, some people might say that's an elitist view, but I do think that engaging people in something that's a little bit outside of the norm, outside of their normal experience, is something that public art can really accomplish. Sort of make people rethink about where they are and the space that they're in their own city and what they think about art. On the other hand, there is something to be said for not creating works that are patently offensive. So, things that may involve, racial stereotypes or gender stereotypes. I mean, there's certain content of art that is perhaps, I feel like I'm treading on thin ice here, but it's perhaps better not to have as part of public art. What I'm always fascinated by and what my research has been driven by is trying to understand how these controversies erupt when you don't have these kind of provocative statements of nudity or mixing sacred and profane symbols. And when you have art that lacks those kind of overt triggers, it becomes a little bit tricky to predict when something might become controversial. Although through my work, I'm really trying to do that. And I do think that if you have, if you place a piece of art in a well-loved location in which a lot of people will be willing to defend it, if you place a very highly visible piece of art that doesn't really match what people, the identity of place, what they think, if they don't think it represents them, then you're likely in for a battle. You're likely going to have a battle. Now, is it a battle that should be avoided? That's a question I don't know if I really want to provide. I don't necessarily think so. Because as we've seen, some of these artworks that have been highly contested at first, I can provide other examples besides Chicago as well. The Kansas City had Klaes Oldenburg and Kusha Van Bruggen's shuttlecocks on the lawn of the Nelson Atkins Museum. And those were really reviled, and the battle royale. But now, they brought acclaim to our city, people come to visit, it put us on the cultural map, and people have really embraced them over time, and they've become a symbol of the city, literally. So it's I don't know if it's a dangerous road to go down to prescribing sort of what you want to do with, trying to avoid controversies or if it's a good or a bad thing. I do think there are basic levels of decorum and taste that you should perhaps not cross with art in a general in the urban environment. The negative ramifications of that, as we saw, you know, in the early 90s and late 80s with the culture wars, though, is that there can be a backlash with funding. And that is the after the culture wars, arts organizations became really cautious. And artists started really rebelling against that. And so I think we're starting to see now a little more opening up. But it took 10 years or so. There was a really conservative climate there for a while.
What typically sparks a controversy, a reaction to public art, when, as you say, it's not overtly offensive?
Again, this is sort of what I've been arguing in my own work, is that there really is about what I call context, the physical location where people receive art, where they look at it, where they encounter it, and that people have preconceived notions about what to expect in certain types of urban environments based on their previous experiences with them. So if there are these certain types of places, either they're centrally located within a city center, or they're very symbolically meaningful. You don't have to necessarily have the city center itself is symbolic, but there are often other places within a city that individuals are very much attached to. If you think about the French Quarter in New Orleans, for example, certain types of locations that have very intense identities, very steeped in symbolism, either with historical events that happened at one time, or they have beloved buildings that are all, you know, literal physical symbols in the environment that people really treasure and they find or that they really want to protect from visual incursions of, you know, of such things such as new art. Does the art fit in with what they think, or does it resonate with what they feel this place is and should be? And if it doesn't, then again, they'll probably very likely rise up to defend the image of the place that they want to protect.
But you said earlier that should not necessarily keep you from putting a piece of public art there. And you cited particularly the Picasso in Chicago in this very visible location of Daley Plaza. If you were advising those who place urban art, public art, and you've already advised, stay away from gender stereotypes, stay away from offensive racial stereotypes. That makes sense. That's obvious. Beyond that, what else would you advise? And I'm particularly curious about how you might advise on this beloved public places, putting something there if you want to risk it. You're saying it's a risk. But if you want to take the risk, somehow matching the emotional attachment or feeling that people get in that place with the sort of art that is placed there.
Well, there are a few strategies one could take, and it's you could either when I was talking earlier about expectations people have of spaces and how they what they expect to see in environments based on what they've seen in the past, one way to sort of have your cake and eat it too, if you will, with art is to have a piece of art that is not that or should I say that complements visually what's going on in that space. Artists, I'm sure, would not really want to hear this because they want their art to be very highly visible, and sometimes they work on contrast. Well, I'll give you an example of a contrast first, and one is De Souvre's The Calling in Milwaukee, which is at the end of Wisconsin Ave, which is now in front of the new Milwaukee Art Museum wing. It was there long before the wing was added. De Souvre painted these I-beams in it looks like an asterisk, and bright orange. I mean, it's actually a very beautiful, cheery orange. And if you look at it against a blue sky, it's just quite stunning. If you look at it against the glass buildings of the Milwaukee skyline, it also is quite beautiful. And now it has the new addition behind it. And against the crisp white of that, it's really quite stunning. However, when the sculpture was first placed, individuals were responding, and even I interviewed people there as well, and they say, well, the bright orange doesn't match the skyline. It doesn't match the museum. It gets in the way. And so you can sort of see how people don't really want, I shouldn't say everybody, but there's a sort of a sentiment out there that we like harmony. So if one way to sort of get around the problem you're sort of saying how I might advise someone is to create with materials or color a piece of art that is very harmonious, literally, with the literal visual of the landscape. The second would be a symbolic harmony, something that I interviewed people in Fort Worth, Texas, about the Richard Serra's Vortex 2002 that's there, one of his newest pieces, literally right outside the museum. The museum is a beautiful, very postmodern, sleek, just absolutely gorgeous building. And Richard Serra's work towers up almost like a rusting corn cob, which I don't know if that sounds very poetic, but it's sort of what it looks like. And it's really an amazing vertical piece of art where you go inside and you can actually hear yourself writing on a pad of paper, the scratching of a pen. I mean, it's really the acoustics in there are really quite amazing. And individuals there are reacting and saying, oh, this is a beautiful modern modern sculpture for a modern building. They really complement each other. So the idea of modernity with modernity. So that symbolic quality of space and that sort of identity of space that's created by buildings that surround it. For example, also in San Francisco, when I talked with individuals there about Mark de Silva's Pax Jerusalem, there's the Palace of the Legion of Honor is there. A very neoclassical building, very beautiful and historical. And then you have a bright red asterisk, you know, in the parking lot. And in some sense, that's symbolic in and of itself, that it's not literally on the grounds of the museum. But the individuals are responding, well, it's modern and bright and red, and you have this beautiful grounds, very European and very classical. And for some individuals, that juxtaposition is a very positive thing. The literal color, along with the sort of symbolic idea of something very modern. But for others, it's not harmonious, and things should sort of match in a theme. On those two levels, those are two ways to sort of work with a very beloved space. I still think there are ways of doing that, maybe pushing the envelope a little bit in either direction to get people to rethink about these spaces that they love so much and that they identify with, you know, one particular type of identity. And maybe push them a little, you know, get them to rethink about this. But there are ways to do that. What happened during the post-culture wars actually was to really create projects that had a lot of local reference, using local artists and having local historical significance, and also creating pieces of art that were literally usable, chairs and benches. That's another way to sort of get people engaged with art and make it maybe a little less threatening and a little more friendly.
Where are your favorite collections of urban art?
Oh, that's in some sense that's an easy and tough question. Maybe it's because I live in Chicago, but I do love Chicago's collection because there's so much variety and there's so much here. I've traveled a bit around the United States, and it's just striking the collection that's here. A lot of other cities have been mired by contentious public art process, such as San Francisco has tried many times. It's getting a little better there, but every time there's a proposal up, it comes under huge debate, and it often dies. So Chicago hasn't had that kind of a problem, and I actually think that that's because of its, in some sense, Mayor Daley, when in his foresight of sort of forging this cultural identity for Chicago, now it's become part of our identity here. So it is what we do. So when you have another piece of artwork, it's almost not news here, quite honestly. Millennium Park aside, other sculptures that were not attached to Millennium Park, it's almost just in a list of galleries. In my research for Redding Cohn's here, Richard Serra's work here in Grant Park, the first mention is not in an arts page. It's in a business column. I have individual sculptures that I really really love from other cities that I've been to. Oldenburg and Van Bruggen's Cupid's Band in San Francisco is stunning along the Embarcadero. And I actually really have very strong memories of Richard Serra's Vortex 2002 in Fort Worth. And Fort Worth itself actually is really a very culturally sensitive city with quite a bit of sculpture. But to just literally have the experience of writing on paper that was echoing throughout, it was really quite memorable.
Kim, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you very much for having me.
Kim Babon is a PhD candidate in sociology at the University of Chicago. After a short break, we'll talk with Faye Nelson, who is leading the redevelopment of Detroit's waterfront. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Tourism Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis in the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Faye Nelson is president and CEO of the Detroit Riverfront Conservancy. Prior to her appointment in 2003, she was vice president of governmental affairs for Wayne State University, where she led the development of the Wayne State University Research and Technology Park. For 15 years, she was senior corporate attorney, then director of government affairs for Kmart Corporation. Faye, over the past 15 years, we've seen many cities develop their riverfronts. What is the riverfront development opportunity in Detroit?
I think the riverfront development opportunity in Detroit is major. To be able to, after several decades of starting and stopping, finally coming together under a public-private partnership initiative to transform Detroit's riverfront, or to develop Detroit's riverfront, will be very transformational as it relates to the impact that it, being this development, will have on our community, on our region, quite frankly, on our entire state.
Why were there so many stops and starts?
Well, that's a great question, which I'm not sure if I can answer, some of which I'm sure is because of economics, some politics, maybe both, don't know. But the good news is that there is a vision, there is a team that is put into place to execute this vision, and we have made tremendous progress in transforming the Detroit Riverfront.
And you say it's a public-private partnership. What role does the city play?
The city plays a major role. The creation of the Detroit Riverfront Conservancy, which is an organization, which is the organization that I had, came out of a 90-day study that was commissioned by Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick. And so because of his major support and his vision, this organization was created with the mission of developing the public space on the Detroit Riverfront. So that includes our constructing a riverwalk and pavilions and plazas and green space, and then taking the permanent operation and maintenance and programming responsibilities of this open space once it's completed from a development standpoint. Without the mayor, we would not, all of this exciting initiative wouldn't be happening today.
And does the city provide funding to you?
Well, the city does not provide funding. I mean, the funding of this organization was launched initially, or the economic catalyst to launch this project came as a result of a major gift granted by the Kresge Foundation. Kresge stepped up and made their largest gift or grant ever to a single project, $50 million, to move this project forward. City, though, has been major in terms of their economic support. They've invested a huge amount of dollars in preparing the infrastructure for the development of the riverfront, in addition to providing funding to support the acquisition of property. And then, of course, there's General Motors that was another major partner that stepped up to the table, developed its own 20 $25 million riverfront presentation, a significant percentage of which they then donated to the Conservancy, in addition to a huge amount of dollars, cash, as well as in-kind support to get this project moving. So three critical partners moving this project forward, which has served as a wonderful leverage opportunity to attract a number of additional corporations and foundations, as well as additional public monies to move this project forward.
You said GM made a $25 million presentation.
General Motors developed their riverfront footprint, which includes a very beautiful plaza as well as a half mile of brand new riverwalk that was completed in December of 2004. The half mile of riverwalk General Motors donated to the Conservancy, so we now have the permanent land control over this space, and we are operating and maintaining and programming this space thanks to General Motors and their major generosity.
And they have their headquarters on the Riverwalk.
Absolutely, the Renaissance Center.
And you said Kresge made a $50 million commitment to this, the largest single commitment Kresge's ever made. That's amazing. What was it about this project you think that Kresge found so compelling?
I think a number of items. The first being the amazing commitment that Kresge has to the city of Detroit is really consistent, in my opinion, with their interest and support of this project. I think in addition to their support of Detroit, their support certainly of the mayor and of all of the key organizations and individuals that were really willing to step up to the table, you know, certainly General Motors and others, to pledge their support to move this project forward.
Let's back up and give me a good description of the real estate of the Detroit riverfront and what that really means, how long it is, where it is in the city, and what you imagine happening to it over time.
Well, let me back up and just begin with our mission and our vision. The mission, as I mentioned earlier, of the Detroit Riverfront Conservancy is to develop the public space on the Detroit Riverfront. And, you know, our development, as I mentioned, is the Riverwalk and the pavilions, plazas, and green space. Our vision is to develop this public space from what we call bridge to bridge and beyond. So as far west as the Ambassador Bridge, which is our bridge to Canada, to as far east as Gabriel Richard Park, that takes you right over another major bridge, the MacArthur Bridge, which once completed provides for over 5.5 miles of developed waterfront. We are in the first phase of that development effort, which is what we call the East Riverfront, 3.5 miles of waterfront once completed. I'm very pleased to share with you that as of today, we have completed, we being the Conservancy, just north of 75% of our East Riverfront project, which includes the construction of additional segments of Riverwalk and the completion of two of four pavilions and plazas that will be strategically located on the East Riverfront. So that's the piece that's the Conservancy's piece of development on the East Riverfront. But there are others that are also developing that the Conservancy is working in partnership with, and that's that public-private partnership. General Motors not only developed their own pavilion and plaza representing their riverfront space, but they're also developing mixed-use retail, largely residential, that's currently underway. The city of Detroit has identified developers for a number of parcels of riverfront property, primarily residential, that are currently under development. We're going to have the first time ever our Port Authority will be located now on the waterfront. They're in the process of developing and building a new terminal and dock that will be located right on the waterfront. And also, the state is in play. They are developing the first state park park ever in an urban area in the state of Michigan will be located on our Detroit riverfront. Once it's completed, it'll be 31 acres in geography. And we're so pleased that they're moving forward with the second phase of their 31-acre development effort. So being the development that's currently underway on the Detroit riverfront is so exciting. It's a $300 million project that has been launched, which we anticipate will leverage over $1 billion of investment for our community.
And for those who are not familiar with Detroit and its riverfront, describe the relationship between downtown Detroit and the river.
Well, the river is at the most southern point of downtown.
And just across the street from it would be City Hall, would be Cobo Hall.
That's correct. The bordering, the streets that border the river are, and perpendicular, you have Jefferson. You have Jefferson Avenue that runs east and west, that runs parallel to the river, and then you have perpendicular Woodward Avenue. And so in that area, just north of Jefferson, there is City Hall. To the east, there's Cobo Hall, which is where we have host our auto show every January. And north of the river is our major downtown area.
And Woodward Avenue is a very major and important street in Detroit. And because that's where many of the cultural attractions are, Wayne State is on Woodward Avenue, it really is a very important connector through the community.
Absolutely. It is the spine that connects the river, our downtown, what we call our lower Woodward area, our midtown area in which Wayne State University is located. And Woodward goes as far north as it goes all the way into the suburbs, as far north as Pontiac, Michigan.
Now, when we think about the Detroit River, what can someone do on the river? Is the Riverwalk made more to provide overlooks and access along the river, or are there places that you can actually get down to the river, get on the river in some way?
Absolutely. The Riverwalk is right on the river's edge, so you will be able to walk, jog, bike, rollerblade on the Riverwalk. The Detroit riverfront shoreline is very distinct and very unique in terms of the look and the feel. There's portions of the Detroit River shoreline that are more urban in terms of its look and feel, some that are more green. So it being the shoreline provides a variety of experiences. There are portions of the Riverwalk that will actually take you all the way down to the river. There'll be places in which you'll be able to fish. There's actually a portion of the Riverwalk that extends over because of the shoreline and the development. This Riverwalk portion actually extends over the river, so that'll provide for a unique experience as well. So, you know, this Riverwalk will provide our community with the opportunity to very closely connect with the Detroit River, which is really not been made available to the community really ever. In a continuous way.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Faye Nelson. She is president and CEO of the Detroit Riverfront Conservancy. Faye, if I'm lucky enough to catch a fish in the Detroit River, can I eat it?
Of course, you can eat it. let me tell you. While our fish are okay, but there's going to be so many other opportunities to enjoy the riverfront when you come down and visit our Riverwalk. Just to tell you a little bit, if I could, about our pavilions and plazas. As I mentioned, we've got four that are planned on the East Riverfront, and at each of the pavilions and plazas, we have a different theme, if you will, for each of the pavilions and plazas. So you will be able to, for example, at our Bard Plaza, there'll be ample seating. All of the plazas are designed with this very interesting tinseled structure that provides for protection from the elements during the day, and they will all be very beautifully lit in the evening. There'll be fountains. There will be, at the Rivard Plaza, for example, there'll be a river carousel for children. There will be our donor recognition walls that will recognize our major donors, and just a host of other wonderful opportunities to enjoy the river at our Gabriel Richard Park Pavilion and Plaza, which is located at the most eastern portion of our development. There'll also be a butterfly garden and a labyrinth. And so it's just going to provide, this being the development, will provide the public with, you know, most importantly, access, you know, to the riverfront. It will provide our community with a sense of place. It will provide a huge amount of opportunity for recreation, educational opportunities as well. The Conservancy looks to partner with a number of our riverfront partners, for example, the state of Michigan being one of them, to provide wonderful educational, environmental type of opportunities for the community. So there'll just be a host of activities, a lot of ways in which you will be able to come and enjoy in a beautiful, clean space our magnificent Detroit River.
I assume that Hart Plaza was completed long before the Conservancy was formed.
That's correct.
Hart Plaza, I visited a couple of months ago and found it to be a pretty hard landscape. And what I was actually most struck by, although I thought the fountain was beautiful, there are a lot of signs in Hart Plaza telling me what I can't do. I don't know if you've noticed them, but there seem to be many activities not allowed, and the signs let you know that. It seems that from what you've described about the new plazas and the new pavilions, that you're taking somewhat of a different approach in the newer pavilions.
Well, we have benchmarked successful riverfronts all over the world. We've looked at riverfronts here within the United States, outside of the United States, and we've got a terrific architect and engineering team in place that has really put together a fantastic design for this redeveloped riverfront. But I have to tell you that we have found as a major component of successful riverfronts is the engagement involvement of the community. It is so important for the community to be part of this. We have always felt it's very important to engage the community, to have them part of this whole process, the development, the redevelopment of our riverfront, that we have engaged the community from day one. And so, we are hopeful that this is a riverfront that the community will enjoy, that the community will use often, because it is their riverfront.
You said you've benchmarked against a number of U.S. cities and cities around the world. Which riverfronts stand out for you? If you could have a riverfront like which city, you would be pleased?
Probably not any one city. I think we've seen a lot of exciting and wonderful, beautifully designed riverfronts in different communities throughout the country. And so what we've done, I think, is drawn from the best of all of these communities, coming back and, we've used that information to assist us in the development and design of the Detroit Riverfront.
Is there one that you like the best?
No, but we're going to absolutely love Detroit's the best.
Why do you think, Faye, it's important to get people back to the river?
The Detroit River is a magnificent river really not enough of our community is aware of. The Detroit River is what we hope will become a magnet to draw people from all over our communities, from the city of Detroit, from the suburban community, from our visitor community. You know, bringing people together to enjoy the waterfront is our goal.
Obviously, a river walk, a riverfront developed in the way you're talking about developing Detroit's, creates value. It creates value in real estate that adjoins the riverfront or is nearby. Do you have any way of capturing any of that increase in real estate value to plow back into the improvements or their operation and maintenance?
Well, actually, we are, as a matter of fact, we are working in partnership with Wayne State University to identify the economic as well as the social impact that a developed riverfront will have on our community. So we're really excited about this study, and we're very excited about partnering with Wayne State University in order to better understand and identify the value added that a developed riverfront will have for our community.
Do you anticipate being able to, again, to capture any of that additional value that you could say, it's the Riverwalk that helped create this value, and therefore let's take that and make sure that we reinvest at least some of those additional tax dollars that are realized off the increased value for operation, maintenance, and programming?
Well, I think that our early thought is to make sure that our investors, that our community understand the return on investment that a developed riverfront will provide the community. So that's our early focus on working with Wayne State University and commissioning such a study.
When you say you'll have 5.5 miles of riverfront, will that be continuous walkway when you're done?
We're hopeful that it will be continuous. It's our goal to have this 5.5 miles be a continuous walkway. You know, as I mentioned earlier, our early focus or our current focus is on 3.5 miles, completing 3.5 miles of developed waterfront. But that being said, we've already begun to look at the west, and there's a number of activities that are currently underway. In March of 2004, the Conservancy, in partnership with the City of Detroit and the community, presented its vision for the West Riverfront. Currently, the Conservancy is working, is one of the key stakeholders to a master plan initiative that's being led by the City of Detroit for the purpose of determining best land use on the West Riverfront. And then finally, thanks to a very generous federal grant provided to the Conservancy by our Michigan Congressional delegation, we are focusing on ensuring that there be public access on the West Riverfront. So there's a lot going on right now with regard to the West, although our primary focus remains on the East. But we're very hopeful that as we begin to launch our West Riverfront activities, and we still have to take that vision and from that vision develop a strategic plan, identify funding sources, that there will be a continuous pathway that will ultimately span from bridge to bridge and beyond 5.5 miles of waterfront once completed.
In your first 3.5 miles, do you introduce any commercial elements at all, whether it's eating, drinking, shopping, anything along the way that punctuates the green space, the pavilions, the public walkways?
Well, separate from what the Conservancy is doing, again, at those pavilions and plazas, there will be concessions as well as other type of other public facilities. Our public-private partners are currently developing mixed-use retail on the riverfront. So while right now it's largely residential, there is retail that's currently being developed.
Faye, good luck with your work. Thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you very much.
Faye Nelson is president and CEO of the Detroit Riverfront Conservancy. Feng Shui is the ancient Chinese practice of placement and arrangement of space to achieve harmony with the environment. In general, people feel good about their surroundings and themselves when things are attractive and in order. This week's City View's commentator Walker Smith examines the connection between us and what's around us.
Several times I have stood alongside the ancient Anasazi granaries hidden in the cliff face 500 feet above the Nankoweap Delta of the Grand Canyon. As I've listened to the guides employ the vernacular of science to explain the location of these granaries in terms of protection from exposure and enemies, my eye has always wandered to the distant view of the Colorado River as it makes a grand panoramic sweep to go roaring away into the wee distance downriver. It's a magnificent vista that never fails to inspire a sense of the sublime. This is an experience we've all had, for we've all been to places like this that put things in perspective and remind us of what we tend to overlook in the hustle and bustle of the day-to-day. I've always thought, standing there at Nankoweap, that scientific explanations don't fully explain why the Anasazi came there to work and live. I think their reasons were no different than ours. They just plain old liked the view. Much the same can be said about our cities and towns. We try to make sense of their reasons for being in terms of transportation and commerce, and we envision future potential in terms of technology and trade. Clearly, these factors shape our communities, but these kinds of explanations fail to tell the whole story, and perhaps the most important part of the story. Because just as it is for places we like to visit, what roots us to one place versus another is often as much about emotions and aesthetics as it is about pure economics. People want more than just the bottom line. People want a place with a view. Emotions and aesthetics, we are told, don't attract business. Perhaps not, but they do attract people, and businesses will migrate to places with smart, motivated people. So in the choice between one transportation hub versus another, emotion and aesthetics may well make the single biggest difference. When we settle in a place with a view, so to speak, life feels good and we feel good about life. And when we encounter life in a grand and glorious way, our own lives feel grand and glorious. I feel quite certain, for no hard evidence that I can offer, that this is the way the Anasazi felt about where they were willing to expend the effort to store their grain. Among the many choices available to them, any one of which could provide protection from exposure and enemies, they chose the place where, every day, they could hike up and take in the view yet one more time. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for our podcast, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders speeding innovation in cities. Information at ceosforcities.org. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.